Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. As I was thinking about these verses, I'm anxious to, looking forward to what Dwayne has to share with us this evening, but just a couple of thoughts as I think about, you know, my own children and raising a family. And, you know, as we think about the responsibility of raising our children, sometimes it's a little scary, a little overwhelming, but it's also a blessing. And just think about the awesome opportunity to, like it mentions here, to look at them as a blessing, first of all, but then also as arrows that, you know, hopefully, Lord willing, that we can teach and train and disciple them to and send them out into the world, and quite the opportunity for a positive, godly impact on the world around us. And sometimes we might mention people that have five children. Don't always, I don't think it seems like that many, but in the world today, I guess, yeah, a lot of people think of that as a lot. And they're like, yeah, wow, you know, how do you do that? Or, well, you must be really busy, or whatever. Different comments people make. And a lot of times it seems like people have a kind of a more of a negative outlook on children, like, you know, oh, they're so much work, and you know, you just, they keep you from having fun and doing what you want to do, and they're little brats or whatever. And but you know, a lot of it comes down to you know, your attitude, our attitude of, you know, are they a burden or are they a blessing, and are we taking the responsibility seriously? Are they just holding us back in life, or are they our mission right now, our primary focus, and you know, who we're putting into the most, and taking our job responsibility seriously, and investing, I guess that was the word I was looking for, investing in our children's lives and in teaching and training them and preparing them for when we do send them out like an arrow. That hopefully they fly straight, hit the mark, and yeah, have a positive influence and continue to impact many people around them as well. So these thoughts on our minds, let's, I guess we'll kneel for a word of prayer.
Get up here where I can see everyone. Good evening, everyone. It's good to see you all here tonight. Appreciate the visitors that come, and we extend you a hearty welcome. So a little review from last week. We looked at the title, What is a Psalm? And we looked at some of the characteristics that are in a psalm. It's a poem. It's a song. It's an expression of worship. Psalms are prayers. Psalms are praise. And we concluded with our heart's desire as we study the Psalms and as we read them and we see the emotions that are expressed in the Psalms. And we looked at three areas: our experience, our expression, and our emotion. And we're challenged to involve all three of these as we worship. And as we worship together in a corporate setting, as well as in our personal devotion. So those are some things we talked about last week. And You know, since my study, since I began to study in Psalms, I've been reading, and I've experienced some of that. When you start getting into the Psalms, it starts working in your heart. And we've had testimony shared of different people that have how the Psalms have spoken to their heart. We could probably spend the rest of the evening just with the testimonies of how a certain verse or a chapter spoke to you. And maybe we'll give time for that if we have time here. Maybe someone would want to share. Excuse me. So tonight we're going to look at Psalms 127. It was it's difficult to try to pick a psalm what you really want to talk about. I was going to talk on Psalm 73, but that's a long chapter, and I was afraid I wouldn't be able to finish that up in the time we have allotted. So we're going to go with Psalm 127 tonight, and probably the last evening we're going to talk about Psalm chapter 1. I know Brother Paul just spoke the other Sunday evening on that, but we're going to go over that. Psalm chapter 1 probably for next week. So I have a title for the psalm tonight, A Word for Workaholics. Now, this might be a different angle on this psalm, but we know. Who wrote this psalm? Did anyone notice who wrote the psalm? Solomon wrote the psalm, okay? And we see that Psalm 127 is a very practical passage in the psalms. It's actually one of the most practical passages in the Bible. It deals with two areas in our life that demand most of our time and they cause us the most trouble. They are also two areas which often compete with each other for our attention and our energy. What are those two areas that we're going to be talking about?
Probably work and children.
Work and family. Thank you. Very good. Work and children, work and family. The two areas of they take almost all of our time, all of our responsibility. In our workaholic society, Christian men often have misplaced priorities with respect to these responsibilities. So, very important topic here tonight. Workaholic pursues his career at the expense of his family. So we know that when we put our mind to work and we are involved in it and we get focused as men, and I'm not excluding the women, but mostly the men here tonight, it's easy to put other things to the side. We are often oblivious to the implications of our conduct when we become workaholics. It kind of just goes over our heads. We don't understand what's going on when we spend so much time at work. I'm going to make a quote from Minerith Meyer to give us a picture of the workaholic's true nature and its results. And I'm going to quote, "The selfishness of the workaholic is much more subtle. While he is out in society saving humanity at a work pace of 80 to 100 hours a week, he is selfishly ignoring his wife and children. He is burying his emotions and working like a computerized robot. He helps mankind, particularly out of love and compassion, but mostly as an unconscious compensation for his insecurity and as a means of fulfilling both his strong need for society's approval and his driving urge to be perfect. He is self-critical and deep within himself feels inferior. He feels like nobody and spends the bulk of his life working at a frantic pace to prove to himself that he is really not, as he suspects deep within, a nobody. In his own eyes and in the eyes of society, he is the epitome of human dedication. He becomes angry when his wife and children place demands on him, and he can't understand how they could have the nerve to call such an unselfish, dedicated servant a selfish husband and father." That was from Minnereth Mountain. Now, I like to qualify that statement. I don't believe in blanket statements, okay? I've kind of shy away from them. I'd like to qualify that statement by saying this might not apply to all quote-unquote workaholics. There could be other reasons for spending so much time at work. So we need to take that statement from Minnereth Meyer for what it's worth, but I think there are some instances outside of that that could apply. In reality, the workaholic's wife and children are correct, and they are suffering severely because of his subtle selfishness. So I do not know of a father listening here tonight who does not agonize about this priorities in the areas of work and family. And if there is such a person who isn't concerned with them, he should be. So work and family are like tugging, they're like at almost like at odds. One, you know, they're demanding our attention. And we're looking for a balance. So let's read the first two verses again, just to kind of refresh our memory. I'm going to read them in the New American Standard. A Song of Ascents of Solomon. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards a city, the watchman keeps wake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved even in his sleep. So we know that Solomon is the author of this psalm, but he's also a contributor of much of the wisdom in the book of Proverbs. In Proverbs, he has many words for the sluggard. So how would you describe a sluggard? When you think of a slug, you think of a slug, you know, just lays there. But a sluggard, what would be some description of a sluggard?
Slow, lazy.
Okay, lazy.
Uncaring
or unconcerned. Another good definition. I think we all know what a sluggard pretty much. Slothful would be another word. A sloth, you know, moves very slowly. Don't get too excited about anything. You almost have to start a fire under them to get them to move. So a sluggard. The sluggard is described as one who avoids work as much as possible. So I'm going to ask for some help here tonight in reading some scriptures. Someone wants to get Proverbs 12, 27 and Proverbs 26, 15. The sluggard delays starting a task and seldom finishes the few things that he starts. Proverbs 12, 27. Someone want to read that? Thank you.
26:15.
Yes. Okay, so we see he's just going to avoid work. He doesn't finish the task that he starts. He always has an excuse for his indolence, no matter how contrived, like found in Proverbs 26:13, two verses before. George, you want to read that?
Slothful man says there's a lion in the way, lions in the street.
Okay, you know what he's doing there. He's yeah, it's an excuse. He imagines the thing. Well, I'm going to get hurt. You know, I don't want to do that. So he makes up excuses. He's constantly being told to wake up and stop sleeping because poverty will overtake him like a thief. Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. Someone would like to read that. Proverbs 6, 9 through 11.
How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet slumber, a little holding of the hands to sleep. So shall thy poverty come to one that travaileth to thy want as an armed man.
Thank you. And also, I'm going to read 24, 33, and 34 also with that. Proverbs 24, 33, and 34, pretty much the same. Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and thy want as an armed man. Solomon's advice here in these verses that we just read is very simple. What's his advice? Get to work, right? That's what we're hearing from Psalm. Get to work. But here in Psalms 127, Solomon is not dealing with the sluggard, but with the one who can't seem to stop working. He just wants to work all the time. And here he addresses the workaholic, showing him the circumstances in which his work is worthless because it is futile. We should understand that we are considering here a very specialized study on the subject of work. It's very narrow. It's very specialized. It's focused in on the subject of work, overwork, I should say. The Bible, the New Testament, does say a lot about work. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do with all thy might. And we read verses like that. And in raising our children, we teach them to be ambitious, you know, and be able to see work. That's one thing, to be able to, you know, just spot what needs to be done and get busy at it. Those are important things to teach our children. But sometimes I wonder, maybe I've taught lessons too well, and sometimes I think, well, now maybe you ought to just, you know, step back a little bit. But that's up to them, and I just praise the Lord that we have industrious children that are willing to work hard and are willing to give as well. So that goes along with the work, the giving as well. We can't forget that. But the subject tonight is a very, very specialized subject on the work of, on the subject of work here in Psalms 127. Any thoughts before we continue on? Okay. Verse 1 describes two instances in which work is vain or futile: house building and the security of a city, in verses 1 and 2. Notice that neither endeavor is considered improper. He doesn't say it's wrong to build houses, doesn't say it's wrong to secure a city, but we need to consider what it is about these two things that makes them improper. Building houses and seeking to preserve the security of a city are both acceptable enterprises. But there is a time when either task can be futile. And when does that time occur? When can either of these tasks become futile? When we do it without seeking God, when we do it on our own without seeking the help of God, that's when they become futile. In each case, our work is in vain when we engage in the activity alone without God's involvement. Solomon begins by telling us that unless God builds our house, our efforts in building are vain. And who would ever have thought that God would be interested in house building? Is he interested in house building? Sure he is. God is really interested in house building. You might say, well, doesn't he have better things to do than worry about our houses? Well, I don't think so. I think he's involved in our everyday lives. It's just simply a matter of making a plan, gathering materials, and putting them all together. We can do that, or we can call Brother Randy Mort, and he'll do it for us. So it's pretty simple, I think, to get things together to build a house. So why does God need to be part of house building? Why do we want God to be part of us building houses.
The whole idea here is a family, not a structure. Structure is for the family.
Okay. Structures, it's about the family. It's for the family. So the first answer is, we'll kind of generalize it. We're told in the New Testament that whatever you do it heartily as unto the Lord. That would include house building. God's interested in every kind of work. There's no work from which we should excuse God. God should be involved in whatever we do. So we may ask, why does God care about house building? Why does he even care? Well, I think God is concerned about how high a priority we would put on our houses. Okay? For some people, having a house of their own is a goal which is absolutely consuming. There are people that build to the degree that they spend their entire life paying for their house. Actually, they're in retirement and they're still paying on their mortgage. I've heard stories about that. How high of a priority are we putting on our houses? The husband and wife may both work to earn the needed money. We see that in society today. In order to afford their house, they both have to work. They may, in the process, neglect their marriage and their family, and most oftentimes they do. The family suffers. And there are many instances where striving for a lovely home has destroyed the marriage. God, remember this, this is a principle that we need to remember. God is not in any venture which is a reversal of biblical priorities. He is not involved in that. The Lord has a very clear word as to our priorities in this matter. Do not be anxious then, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we clothe ourselves? For all these things the Gentiles eagerly seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And what's going to happen? They'll all be added to you. God cares about how high a priority we place on our homes, on our house building. God also cares about our motives. A house is a symbol of status in our society. You see big, fancy houses, and that's a status symbol. We want the biggest and the best house that we can afford in the right part of town. If our security is somehow intertwined with earthly possessions, then we are trusting in material things and not in God. So where's our trust? Where's our trust? Where's our confidence? Is it in our houses? Is it in our lands? Is it in our bank accounts? I hope not. So now we get to the question, when is house building vain? We can answer that question. House building is vain when we engage in it without God. And when does God not build our house with us? He doesn't build our house with us when we have wrong priorities, wrong motives, and wrong methods. God cares about what we do, why we do it, and how we do it. He cares about all those things. And when we have the wrong motives and we go about it in the wrong way, we are not letting him have part of that. God is concerned about the building of houses because so many of us are preoccupied with just such efforts. We are preoccupied, if we want to admit it or not, we are preoccupied with our work. And some of us probably work too much and we're too focused on our work. We often heard the saying that we worship our work, we work at our play, and we play at our worship. Can just keep going round and around and around with that. We worship our work, we work at our play, and play at our worship. And I pray that our study here in Psalms will help us reverse that. Okay, any thoughts?
How about building a house? biblical people that reward us for not building houses.
Okay.
Jeremiah 35, the Rechabites.
Mm-hmm.
They were told by their ancestors not to build houses, not to plant vineyards, just to be a matter.
Yep.
And they were rewarded for it. If you think about it, part of building a house is to protect, you know, the walls protect. Their children would have been laying in between them. They would have been the walls for their children and so on. There's a lot involved there. It kind of gives an illustration of what Psalms is really talking about.
Right. Thank you. Anyone else? Our houses may destroy us as a family. It may keep us from fellowshipping with God and our fellow saints. And it may divert our energies from seeking His kingdom to building one of our own. Are we interested in building God's kingdom or our kingdom? You know, that's what's behind what the psalmist is trying to tell us here. Such misdirected or mismotivated effort is futile, for it seeks to trade off the eternal in preference for what is temporal. Are we worried about the temporal over the eternal? It is vain because our hearts are wrong before God. It is worthless because we are serving the wrong master. Am I serving myself, or am I serving God and others? Matthew 6:19 through 21, lay not up for yourselves treasure on earth, where moth or rust destroy or corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust corrupts, nor thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Okay, moving on quickly from the building of houses to the watchman tasks to ensure the security of a city. This too can be in vain. We know that security has always been a priority to men. In ancient times, they built huge walls around the cities. Various points along the walls were elevated. They had towers. Watchmen were stationed there all hours of the day and night. Isaiah 62, let me see if I can find that quick. Isaiah 62 in verse 6, we read about that. Isaiah 62 in verse 6, I have set a watchman upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day or night. Ye that make mention of the Lord, keep not silence. So these walls had towers where men could watch day and night, around the clock. They warned the people of the city of imminent attacks. If they saw something or heard something at night, they warned the people of that. So what do we have today in place of towers and securities, people up there watching? Have cameras, right? Cameras everywhere. You can't go anywhere without having your picture taken. So today they replaced the walls or the guards with cameras. So it's not as difficult to envision God as being concerned with our security as it is with our building of houses. After all, God cares about us and our well-being. But when is God not part of our efforts to maintain security? When is He not part of that? I think there are two principal occasions in the Bible when God removed Himself from the business of security. First is when safety is sought in the midst of sin. When we are in the middle of sin and we seek security. The sinner is never secure in sin. The people of Babel sought their security in a city and in building a tower. God had commanded men to disperse and to populate the earth. They wanted to keep everyone together. How about Sodom and Gomorrah? They were defenseless because God judges sin. God rained down fire. We are most secure when we are obedient to the will of God. We read 2 Kings chapter 6. in the middle of God's will is when we're the most secure. Conversely, we are at least secure when we persist in our sin. When we are in sin and we persist in it, our security is gone. It's vain. The second area is man is vulnerable when he strives for security in his own strength. Our safety is only in God. Our efforts to be secure distract us from our devotion to God, and we have no protection. So we see that Lot chose Sodom and Gomorrah. I suspect that he felt living there would give him security. He chose the best land, and he said, Abraham, you can have the rest. So what happened? Who was kidnapped? Lot was kidnapped. Who had to rescue him? Abraham. So we see that really didn't have much to do for keeping him secure. Lot lost everything, including his wife and his honor, but Abraham was exalted. The nation of Israel sought to establish security by making alliances with other nations. They relied on the arm of flesh, but security depends on God alone. When we seek to be secure in our own efforts, it is an exercise of futility. Verse 1 describes the futility of work, which arises from improper motives and self-endeavor. Verse 2 seeks to show us another misuse of work. So work is vain whenever it goes beyond the limits God has set for it. Any labor is wrong when it is excessive. There are boundaries that we need to keep in mind. Work becomes vain when it is concerned with the wrong activity. So too, it becomes vain by going beyond reasonable limits of time. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. There's a time and a place for everything. We'll take the time to read that here tonight. When our work totally consumes us, we do not have time for other important responsibilities. Too much work is counterproductive. In verse 2, we read that when our work causes us to get up very early and retire very late, it is vain. But there are some exceptions. We all know that occasionally we need to burn that midnight oil. When things need done, sometimes we need to put extra hours in. In fact, the Proverbs 31 woman, the virtuous woman, is praised for doing this in verses 15 and 18. She's commended for being hardworking and not slothful. Solomon is not contradicting Psalm 31 here. He's just putting it in perspective. While everyone finds occasion which extra work and effort is required, the workaholic is the man who has made this his pattern. This is the pattern for the workaholic. It's the rule and not the exception, where he works excessive hours. So the last phrase of verse 2 is interesting, that it says that he giveth his beloved sleep. That's in the King James Version. And there are several other phrases that are given depending on which translation you would use. There's two possible meanings here, I believe. While only one may be intended, I think it's possible that both could be taught here. The interpretation of this statement hinges on the translation we choose for the final clause of verse 2. One translation renders it, "For he grants sleep to those he loves." Another renders it, "For he gives to his beloved even in his sleep." So the first translation, "For he grants sleep to those he loves." The reason why the workaholic toils in vain is because he has failed to appreciate the delicate balance between the need for work and the necessity of rest. The workaholic has lost his perspective on what is necessary evil and what is gracious good. By working day and night, men cannot give diligence, attention to more important matters such as study, meditation in scriptures, worship, devotion, attention to family, and so on. There's another way in which we may view the statement in verse 2. Prolonging our labor is vain because it violates a basic spiritual principle. God gives to those who have learned to rest in Him, not to those who strive in their own strength. In the words of the psalmist, as translated by the NASB, he says, "For He gives to His beloved even in His sleep." So God's blessings are the product of His grace, appropriated by faith, not works. Work is futile when we strive by means of it to gain God's blessing. In other words, if we're striving by our own human efforts to gain God's blessings, it's futile, it's vain. That's how that can be translated. Now, the one who works, Romans 4, verse 4 and 5, the one who works, his wage is not reckoned as a favor, but as what is due. But to the one who does not work, who believes in Him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is reckoned as righteousness. God not only gives sleep to His children, He also gives to His children in sleep. That is when there is no toiling and striving, only resting in His goodness and faithfulness. So God rewards us even greater when we rest in Him. We need not toil for that. We need not labor for that, for His blessings, His goodness and His faithfulness. So time is just flying here tonight. So we keep moving here. An illustration of God's gift as grace, of grace. And we read about children there as a gift of God's grace. Verses 3 through 5. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children in the of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. Some scholars have suggested that this psalm was originally two separate psalms. And they propose this because the connection between verses 1 and 2 and 3 and 5 is a mystery to them. So it seems like it's another completely different thought. But there is a connection. I asked a brother here before the service tonight, what is the connection between children and a workaholic? He said, well, children are a lot of work. So I guess that could be a connection. But children provide an excellent conclusion for the arguments of verses 1 and 2. Children illustrate and apply positively the truths previously taught from a somewhat negative perspective. The provision of children differs from that for which men toil. When men work, they are striving for wages, not a gift. Wages are what we produce with the work of our hands. Gifts are those things generously and graciously given to us by another. Children in verses 3 and 5 to 5 or a gift from God. We never, ever need to forget that. We got to remember that. They are a great reward. Isn't it interesting that children, while given by God, are conceived when we are at rest and not when we toil? How beautiful is the illustration then of what we are told in verse 2, that God gives to His beloved in His sleep. In verses 4 and 5, we are taught that children, a gift from God, provide us with the very thing for which men strive in vain. A man may toil to build a house, but by giving us children, God builds our homes, right? He's building our homes with children. We strive for a house, but do we have a home when we have a house? We don't have a home unless we have love and children there. He gives us our home. The watchman stands guard to provide security and protection. But the children God gives provide a greater security. At the end of the chapter said, they speak with the enemies in the gate. That's security. Solomon poetically describes them as arrows in the hand of a warrior. They go where we can't go, and they accomplish things that we can't accomplish. That's a picture of an arrow going out. The children born in a man's youth are strong and well established by the time he has reached old age. I remember Dad always told us, have your children when you're young. Don't wait till you're old to have your children. Have your children when you're young, when you have energy, and then you can enjoy your grandchildren. Have your children when you're young. Don't wait. His quiver is full of children will look after. His quiver full of children will look after the aged man and his wife. We see in verse 5, the city gate was a place of business. It was also a place where justice was administered. The scriptures assume that the widows and orphans were more vulnerable in need of greater protection since they had no one but God to safeguard their interests. Ezekiel, or Exodus 22:22, Deuteronomy, Psalms 94:6, all talk about that. The parents of many children had no such worry. Their children saw to it that their parents were treated with respect and with honesty and justice. Let the enemies try to take advantage of them. Just let the enemies try to take advantage of their parents. They would speak with them in the gates. So in conclusion, any thoughts before we wrap this up? You want to say?
I was thinking in regards to society today, they have greater respect for adults than the reward of God, which is their children.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's sad.
It is sad.
Very sad.
Can you be a church workaholic or a Bible workaholic?
I think so.
I was thinking Jesus' disciples were so busy, said they didn't have time to eat, and Jesus called them away to work.
Yep.
I mean, there are stories of missionaries and that that worked themselves to death, and not saying that was wrong. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
I come from a background that we know a little bit about arrows, and when you put fletchings on arrows, you put them on a certain angle so they get the proper spin. The other thing is, when you're shooting them, you have to make sure when you release them, not only are you on the bullseye, but you do what's called a follow-through. And that's a lot of times what does not happen with our children. Do we follow them through and make sure that they hit the mark?
Thank you. It's good stuff. Okay, conclusion. Do we see the point here of Psalm 127? What is the point? The man who puts too much stock in his labor is the man who has failed to understand the grace of God. In His grace, God has provided man with a time of rest and relaxation. And in His grace, God has made provision for many of our needs through the gift of children. Contrary to the thinking of the workaholic, God's gifts are not acquired by feverish efforts, burning the candle at both ends, but by resting in His grace. That's where God's gifts come from, resting in His grace. In my estimation, this psalm is the Old Testament counterpart of John 15:1-11. I am the vine, you are the branches. Jesus teaches us that the key to being fruitful is abiding in Him, not in frantic efforts. I do not mean to suggest that abiding in Christ precludes activity, but I do think it should govern our work. We need not strive to the point that God's priorities are reversed. We dare not strive beyond the limits God has given us. God has given us limits. He's given us all limits. Our activities should leave room for important concerns like raising children, having time for rest, reflection, worship, and so on. We, sadly enough, have reversed our priorities from that given here in this psalm. Many have come to view children as a curse, which Brother Josh mentioned about in the opening, and as a means of finding and work as a means of finding fulfillment and security. This is evident in the trend of the women's movement They are seeking to be released from the slavery and drudgery of homemaking. Instead, they are pursuing careers to find fulfillment. This is demonstrated by two observations. At worst, many women prefer abortions to relinquishing their occupations. They'd rather have an abortion instead of having to quit work. At best, other women are willing for their children to be raised by institutions rather than to rear their own children at home. Finally, this psalm contains a principle which relates to those who may never have come to a personal relationship in Jesus Christ. No matter how much you labor to earn a righteousness which you hope God will accept, your efforts will always be futile. Your works will never be acceptable to God. Hebrews 4 through 11, and also Psalms 95, 7 through 11, talks about entering into His rest. God has chosen to save men by His grace and not by their works. To be saved, you must recognize yourself as a sinner, and your efforts to be righteous apart from God are worthless. You can be saved simply by resting in Him. He has sent His Son to be punished for our sins on Calvary, and we can rest in that. We can rest in Him, in His salvation. Jesus is the one whose righteousness can be ours simply by trusting in Him and receiving salvation as a gift of God's grace, that we do not have to work for that. In Him alone, you will find the security which God gives for eternity. We will be eternally secure in God if we rest in Him. So the main message of Psalm 127, in closing, is that all human effort, success, and security are ultimately vain and meaningless without God's blessing and involvement. Emphasizing His sovereignty as the true source of building, protection, provision, and family, it urges dependence on Him rather than on anxious toil. And it highlights that even hard work, guarding a city or building a house, fails unless the Lord is involved, and that children are a precious gift and a heritage from God that brings strength. Any closing thoughts before we conclude? This is just a short psalm, but I've been challenged in my heart by this psalm tonight, and I just pray that you would have been as well. May God richly bless you, and we'll have a brother come and have closing here.
Brother Dwayne, for his studies that he put into that, the thoughts he brought to us. I guess what I take from this is whatever we do, involve God in it. Let Him make what we do successful or fruitful. Let's stand, I guess, for a closing prayer, and then Brother Dustin will lead us in a closing song.